shaking her head. "Don't say anything more, Lucy. I won't listen. I won't believe you." "Alice, you're confused." I stopped, looking at her, imploring. "Do you really think that I would ever do anything to hurt you?" I saw her hesitate, but then she shook her head swiftly, as if determined to convince herself. "You need to leave by tomorrow." She turned, as if to go, but stopped, her words glinting, sparking in the darkness. "And if you don't, I'll telephone the police and tell them exactly what you've done." She crossed the hallway and closed the door to her bedroom. The lock turned, loud and resounding. I did not sleep that night. Instead, I sat, watching as the light broke into the room, casting long shadows across the walls before me, my eyelids feeling heavy, my thoughts scattered and confused. When morning arrived, full and bright, I left the flat. Once outside, I began to walk. I went down narrow paths and tight corners to familiar places and new territories. I walked until my feet hurt, until they cracked and bled. I discovered the tomb of Ibn Battuta, the explorer. I laid my hand across the rough wall, brushed my fingers across the plaque that had been placed in his honor. And just like him, I refused to stop. I was not tired. Thirst and hunger did not exist. I pushed ahead, the knowledge that I had to keep walking, that I must keep walking, buried somewhere deep within me. It was the most important thing. I must not stop. I must not think too hard. At the end of it, I knew all would be right. Alice would come to her senses, she would tell John what we had decided, and the two of us would leave. Head back to England together, maybe stop in Spain for a few months first. I imagined it. The pair of us in Madrid, then Barcelona. We would drink sherry in one and gin in the other. We would sit outside until the sun faded and night crept in, eating tapas and drinking Rioja. Alice would like that better than gin. And then I stumbled, a rock I had not seen, a piece of debris sticking out of the ground that had hidden itself. It was a short fall, but enough to wrench my ankle so that it smarted when I tried to place my full weight on it. No one had seen. I was alone in an empty alleyway. And yet, despite this knowledge, my cheeks burned with embarrassment, with anger. I had loved this country from the moment I first stepped foot on its shores, and yet this was the way it treated me, placing unforeseen obstacles under my feet, causing me injury in its filthy streets, the ground covered in a litany of bodily fluids that I shuddered to think of, my hands and knees now red with scratches, my ankle useless. I thought of Alice. It was the same, wasn't it? I had done everything for her, loved her, watched out for her, and she had treated me just the same. Hiding things, obscuring my vision, making me think I was safe. The buzzing in my ear increased. I batted at it, desperate. The effort it required to remain calm seemed impossible, insurmountable. I could feel the anger, the rage boiling just beneath my skin. Tiny pinpricks emerged along my arms, followed by larger, more sinister red hives. And yet, despite the heat, my skin refused to sweat. It was trapped somehow inside my body, refusing to come out. The results were red, angry welts that rose across my arms and ran up and down my stomach. I could feel them spreading from my neck and onto my face. A man rounded the corner. I ignored him, willing him to do the same, daring him to do otherwise. He passed by me silent, and for a moment I felt the anger start to retreat. Then he turned and spoke. "Smile. Be happy." I shot him a look, one that boiled with hatred, overflowed with violence. He shrank backward, and I was suddenly anxious to get away from him, from this putrid-smelling alley. No, not anxious, desperate. I was desperate to get away, feeling my cheeks flush red again, hot with newfound anger. I was embarrassed, and I was angry that this man was able to make me feel this way, that anyone could make me feel this way. I could feel it, as I had in the past, growing out of control, as it had that day of the accident. I could feel its energy coursing through my body as if I had been shocked, zapped, brought back to life so that all of me was burning, electric, and the source of energy could no longer be contained. It took everything in my willpower not to lunge at him. I knew rationally that my anger had nothing to do with him, that it was directed somewhere else altogether. At the same time, I was powerless to stop. I did not want to. I worried that if I did, I would simply break apart, break down the anger and power. Yes, it felt powerful, seeping out of my pores and leaving me small and pitiless, a figure to be laughed at, one to be derided. I felt the tears begin to well. "Get away from me!" I hissed, aware that while he probably would not understand my words, he would by no means miss my tone. A look of confusion swept across his features. I almost wished that he would do something. Shout, slap, spit, something, anything. But all he did was slink away down one of the city's countless alleys, disappearing into the labyrinthine maze. In that moment, I felt nothing but contempt for all of them. I hated John and his confident smirk. I hated the nameless faces that I had to push past in order to find one solitary spot in the sea of strangers. And even for the briefest of moments, I hated her. Alice. I had done everything for her, traveled halfway across the world in order to find her, to rescue her from the mess that she had made of our life. I hated her for her weakness, her spinelessness, for always going back on the decision she had made. There was only one thing to do now. I turned quickly, leaving behind the darkened alley and heading back to the heart of the Medina, back to the Petit Soko. I slipped into Café Tingis, ordered a coffee, and then asked the waiter to use the telephone. I dialed the number, hoping he would still be home, hoping he would be the one to answer. I held my breath and waited to hear John's voice. Alice was not supposed to have been in the car that night. Tom was not supposed to have died. But then we had fought. A torrent of angry words and accusations, powerful enough to match the snowstorm raging outside us. A blizzard, I had later heard it referred to. So that by the time I had realized what was happening, the car pulling up, Alice stepping inside, the storm at its zenith, the roads were covered in a sheen of ice, and the accident was far worse than I had ever intended. I had meant it as a scare, imagining, as I felt for it underneath the hood of Tom's car, alongside the firewall, moving quickly, my hands working from memory, from experiences I no longer wanted to claim as my own, as I inhaled the deep, unnerving scent of oil that was both home and somewhere else entirely foreign, a broken leg, a lost scholarship, something that would take him far and away from Alice so that we would be alone once more. With a pair of pliers, I had crimped the line, knowing it would affect the pressure, affect the brakes, but I had not expected it to burst, had not expected the snow and the ice and the mountains, and Alice. I had tried to stop her, to warn her, but she wouldn't listen. I had thought about following, about pushing past, crawling into the car alongside her, but I had stopped, frozen from both the growing storm around us and the words she had spoken to me, about disappearing, about never wanting to see me again. She had fixed me with a look of such anger, such hatred, that I had been rendered useless by my surprise. Afterward, I had gone back inside, had stood in our quiet little room, and had realized it was over, that there was no longer a reason for me to stay. And so I had packed my bag, a single suitcase, nothing more, filled only with the things that I had come there with, a few dresses, a couple pairs of stockings, those bits I had acquired along the way, a novel from the town bookstore, a pressed leaf from the previous autumn. These I left behind. At first, I had thought to avoid the main road and what I might find there. But then I had thought of the woods, of the darkness and the snow, and I had pushed ahead. Walking through the blizzard, my hands shaking, blue and numb, I had paused at the wreckage that my desires had conjured, had stood, wondering, my blood thrumming loudly within my ear, what it was all for. I had found Alice lying in the snow a good distance from the car, her body smeared with red and black, nearly unrecognizable. And as I stood over the lifeless body of the girl I had loved, the consequence, I thought, of my dreaming, of my wanting, I had felt it. The darkness around me, transforming and moving me, making me into something that I had not intended, a monster I had not foreseen. I had moved to New York, to the city, stopping first by the garage I had grown up in, which only days earlier I had been thankful for the summers I had endured, sweating alongside the other men in the building, casting them murderous glances when their own lingered too long. From the garage, I had taken what little money was in the register. It was owed, I thought, from my years of servitude, and purchased a one-way ticket on Greyhound. Once there, I did not bother to change my name. The city was big, and no one would come looking for me, I knew. And so I had disappeared, into a boarding house with a dozen or so other girls, running from abusive husbands or neglectful husbands, or those just running toward something more. Those first few weeks I had scoured the newspapers, searching for an obituary. There was a tiny newsstand several blocks away from my rented room that carried our town's local paper, and I would make the daily trip, my shoulders shaking in the cold morning air, certain that each new day would bring the announcement I was waiting for, was dreading. A week passed before one appeared for Thomas Stowell, the length of the notice a testament, it seemed, to the great and long line of white-collared Stowells he had descended from, as if such lineage demanded that his passing be recognized. I waited for a similar mention of Alice, but there was nothing. And as the days passed, the man behind the newsstand expecting my arrival, paper in hand, comfort, I supposed he wrongly assumed, for a homesick girl in a new city, I began to feel the justice of it all. It was fate. It was punishment, this eternal waiting. My days were marked by it, my anonymous footfalls that took me from boarding house to newsstand to work and back again, all that I could hope for now. And for a while I convinced myself that I could do it, that I could continue on, hidden in the cold gray emptiness of the city, the perfect cloak to hide my monstrosity from the world. But then, one day I had seen her, Alice's guardian, Aunt Maud. I watched her emerge from a taxi not 5 feet away from where I stood. She wore a smart dress that looked as though it cost more than my entire year's salary. Her hair sleek and expensive, and though I had never met her before, I recognized her instantly from the pictures that Alice had kept in our dorm room, and so I moved toward her, needing, in that moment, to be close to someone who had once been close to Alice. I had pulled my threadbare coat closer to my body, hoping that it would hide my even more depressing dress, which had begun to rub in places from so much use that it wasn't impossible to see through the fabric. "Miss Shipley," I called out. Alice's aunt had turned, her eyes quickly taking in my form, her lips turned down in displeasure. "Yes?" she asked, her tone curt. "Miss Shipley," I repeated, fixing my face with a small smile. "I thought it was you." I ignored the slight frown that had settled on her face as she tried and failed to place me in her life. "I went to school with your niece, Alice." It was the first time in months that I had said her name aloud, and the words stuck, caught in my throat. At the mention of her niece's name, Maud Shipley's face changed, though it did not relax, I noted. "Did you?" "Well," she said, "I'll make sure to tell her you said hello." And with that one sentence, that one promise, everything changed. Later, I decided that Aunt Maud's presence was a sign, one that could not be ignored, one that demanded, no, begged for my attention. And I felt it then. The thread that held Alice and myself together began to pull, taut. We were not finished. Not yet. Our story was still being written. It was fate, I decided later, as I felt the darkness that had hovered above me throughout my time alone in New York begin to recede, my sad little rain cloud pulling away at last. I had moved closer to Aunt Maud and said, "Actually, it's quite fortunate that I met you here. I've been trying to get an updated address for her, alumnae stuff, you see, and I haven't been able to find it anywhere. I don't suppose she's still at her old address, the one in London?" Her eyebrows arched, and she asked, "And what did you say your name was, my dear? I don't believe I caught it." "Oh," I said, my gloved hands moving to my throat. "How silly of me. I'm so sorry, Miss Shipley. I'm Sophie, Sophie Turner," I replied, using the name of a girl who had lived down the hall from us at school, a forgettable figure that most of the other girls only ever spoke to because of who her parents were, because of what their wealth meant. I had kept up to date with a few of them, using my resources at the publishing company and the newspaper to do a bit of digging, reading with envy of their accomplishments, their plans. So I knew Sophie Turner had been a bit of a disappointment. She had married, though not particularly well, and was living out her days deep in the South, in some state I hoped never to cross the border of, in a town that rolled easily off the tongue and out of the mind. I knew from experience that she was a girl no one could ever remember by sight alone, though they knew the name, knew the weight of it. I had reaped the advantage of this for a time, so when drinks were placed on bar tabs or an occasional night stayed in a hotel, it was always with a smile and a nod of the head, no questions asked, and no chance of an embarrassing run-in with a girl no one could remember. Then the Turners had experienced some sort of financial crisis. I had never bothered to learn the specifics, and the managers then became more reluctant to book rooms, to serve drinks without any guaranteed method of payment. Still, I used the name when it suited me, and now, standing in front of a woman who represented all the things the Turner name had once stood for, I found its usefulness once again. At the sound of the name, Maud smiled, though it was still tight, and told me of Alice's husband, of Tangier. "A part of me regrets introducing them," she had confided, the frown line between her eyes deepening at the words. "But how on earth was I supposed to know that he would whisk her away to Africa?" For according to Maud, she wasn't at all certain that her niece was happy. Wasn't entirely convinced, in fact, that her husband had married her for anything beyond her money. "Can you imagine it?" she had demanded. "A girl like her in a place like that?" It was those words, more than anything else, that persuaded me in the end. Maud took a small metallic notebook from her handbag, its outside a darkly embossed botanical design, the kind one saw in Victorian wallpaper, and using the gilded pen within, wrote the address on a slip of paper. I took it, my hand trembling as I placed it into my pocket. The very next day, I withdrew my rent money from the bank and stood in line at the ticket office for Cunard, booking a passage across the Atlantic. We had been walking for nearly 15 minutes. During that time, neither of us had spoken. At first, I thought maybe the temperature was to blame for his silence, for while the sun had set, there was still a powerful heat that seemed to burn against the back of my bare head. I could feel my blouse cling to my body, smell the scent of my own sweat as the material around my armpits dampened. I wondered if he could feel it too, but he always looked so unbothered by the heat, it was impossible to tell. Perhaps it was just an affectation, like most of his life, or perhaps he was still upset after last night. I wondered if that was the real reason he looked straight ahead at the road in front of us, at anyone and anything, it seemed, but me. Then, at last, he spoke.
"I know you saw us."
His voice was neither kind nor threatening. The words were spoken without emotion, as if waiting to see how I would react. I looked at him. You and Sabine. I saw the flash of surprise on John's face. He had not expected me to know her name, and I wondered what he would have said if I had remained quiet, if he would have eventually tried to pass it off as something innocent, a colleague, a wife of a friend, as I suspected he would have that day in the Casbah.
I won't ask you how you figured that out, he said,
that same teasing smile emerging on his face once more, that there was something half-hearted in the gesture, as if he could no longer muster up enough energy for such pretense.
I'm surprised, of course, but you seem rather resourceful.
He cleared his throat.
Have you told Alice?
I smiled and said instead, I'm leaving soon, John, and Alice wants to leave with me. I noticed the change in his face, the way his eyebrows dipped, not quite a frown, nothing quite so declarative as disapproval. It was confusion, I decided. Was he really so naive as to think that Alice would not leave him following his indiscretion? We continued walking to our destination, and almost instinctively I moved away, creating a slight gap between us as we continued. I wondered whether it would be violent, his reaction, or whether he might cry and beg me to change her mind. I couldn't decide which one displeased me more. We moved slowly, the night setting in fast. Already it was becoming more difficult to see, the lights of the Medina far behind us.
You've told her then?
He asked, though his voice sounded neither fearful nor worried. Instead, it was almost as though he were amused, as if the notion that I had shared the news of his infidelity with Alice was something trivial, something to be cast aside. She didn't need me to tell her, John. I paused. She already knew. She'd figured it out all on her own. He was silent for a moment, and he nodded as if attempting to let the words settle.
Yes, I sometimes supposed she would. She's not dim, that one, is she?
He said with a short, quick laugh that conveyed his uneasiness. No, she's not. I swallowed the bitter taste in my mouth. So what will you do? He looked at me.
About what?
About Alice. I stopped. Surely you don't expect her to stay with you, not after this. He let out another laugh. This one more real, more authentic, I thought.
And why wouldn't she?
He asked.
All this was her aunt's idea, you know. Both she and my mother had been quite keen to introduce us, and though I suspect I'm not Aunt Maud's favorite son-in-law, I think faced with the option of having to care for Alice herself, or having someone else take care of her, well...
I turned to him, my step momentarily faltering. He must have sensed my confusion, even in the night, for he continued,
Alice isn't going anywhere, Lucy. I think you know that. Beyond all the family ties, we're good for one another. We're, what do you call it? Symbiotic. Isn't that one of your fancy terms? We need each other, Alice and I. Haven't you already figured that out? I need her money. Well, maybe not need, perhaps appreciate would be the better word.
He laughed.
And she needs me to keep her out of the loony bin.
I stopped. We had arrived. Even in the darkness, I could see him looking around, trying to familiarize himself with his surroundings. He didn't recognize the place, which told me that he had never been there before. I was glad. It would make things easier. I had decided, sitting at Cafe Tingus, John was the problem, the patriarchal head that had to be cut off, the dragon that had to be slain in order to rescue the heroine. I could not compete against John, just as I never could with Tom. Not really, for the world told me this was not possible. I was their better in every way but one. I only needed to best them in order to make Alice see this as well, that her future lay not with them but with me. I could feel the insistence in the air beating strongly. The days of suppression, of subjugation, were dwindling for the Moroccans, and I thought in that instance that I could feel it, the herald sounding for myself, for Alice as well.
"She will," I said, my voice flat and even. "She will come with me. She will see that it's the right decision."
"Lucy," he said, his voice tinged with something like irritation now. I could feel it, his temper growing, fanned by my insistence, my determination. "Alice doesn't care about this whole mess with Sabine, not really," he continued, his words rushed. "If she had, don't you think she would have said something, done something by now?"
I struggled to find my voice. "She's afraid of you."
"No, Lucy," he laughed. "She just knows there isn't any better option, not for a woman like her."
I felt it then. My breath jagged, sharp so that it hurt to breathe, so that each and every inhale was labored, painful.
"This is my favorite place in all of Tangier," I said, pushing the feeling aside. "Those are tombs just below you." I paused, turning to him, my voice wavering with emotion. "Alice will come with me, John. She already agreed to it while we were in Chef Schauen. She's already decided to leave you. You're just not smart enough to have realized it yet." He lunged then, and surprised I lost my balance, falling to the hard, dusty ground.
"You bitch," he spat.
I pushed backward, working to right myself, to keep away from him so that he would not be able to stand over me, towering. I couldn't see his face clearly, not in the darkness, but I imagined it was red, swollen with anger. It seemed absurd that he would be so enraged. He had had Alice, and he had let her go, traded her for that other woman. I think that was it. The thought of his betrayal, which convinced me absolutely that it was the right thing to do. The only thing to do, I knew then. John had subsumed Alice entirely, rendering it impossible for her to survive autonomously. As long as he existed, she could not. There was only one way to free her, to ensure that she would not always belong to him, to this place. I thought then, too, of how much John loved Tangier, realizing that he was right. Things were changing, shifting, and Tangier, all of us, would never be the same again. I knew that if he could, he would choose to remain there forever, with her, his Tangier, just as she was in that moment of time. Once I realized that, the rest was surprisingly simple.
Part 3 Chapter 11 Alice. When I woke that morning, for one strange, beautiful moment I was back in New England. I could feel the frozen blast of the winter months, could smell the cold, clean air, so that I moved to bury myself deeper within my bed, reaching for the familiar comfort of down. But then that feeling of euphoria shifted, tilted, replaced instead by a growing urgency, a sense that something was wrong, the realization pulling me under, farther and farther, until I could no longer find my way out from under it. My stomach ached, and I kicked and clawed, but it was no use. I was back there again, in Vermont, and it was no longer nostalgic and breathtaking. There was now a darkness, something large and uncontrollable that threatened to hold me within its grasp once more. I saw Tom then, lying in the snow, the white, pristine blanket underneath him bleeding slowly into a deep, startling red. I stepped closer. No, it wasn't Tom at all, I realized. It was John, still and motionless. Dead. And suddenly I knew that... I sat up abruptly. Someone was knocking at the door. My head still slow with dreams, I turned to John to see if he had heard the knocking as well. I saw his empty side of the bed and remembered. The other night at the bar, the kiff, the drinks, his subsequent disappearance to Fez, which I could not blame him for, the need to escape apparently one of the few things we shared between us. After all, I had run to Chef Schauen while he had waited at home. Now, it seemed, I would do the same, waiting until he re-emerged on the doorstep from Fez, tired and full of the realization that there was no escape from the life we had created with one another. I took a deep breath, willing my heart to slow, willing the sweat on my skin to dry, but the thought of John, pale and silent, remained before my eyes. It seemed ages since I had last seen him in front of me. I had stayed in bed the morning after our night out, nursing a horrendous hangover, so I wasn't even entirely certain what time he had arrived home, whether he had passed the night beside me, in our bed, or out on the sofa. I had woken to the sounds of him in the kitchen, making breakfast, a boiled egg and a slice of umsemen, followed by a quick cup of tea. It was always the same. Later I had heard the phone ring, Charlie, I presumed, remembering what he had mentioned about Fez, and the closing of the front door not long after that. I had listened, after, for sounds of Lucy, for any indication that she was packing, leaving, but there had only been silence. A few hours later, tiptoeing past her door, sometime in the late afternoon, judging by the way the light fell against the walls, insistent, as if clinging to life, I chanced a quick look into her room. It was empty. I had exhaled, feeling something like relief as I returned to my own bedroom and crawled back between the sheets, content to let the day slip by from the comfort of my bed, certain that everything was at last working its way back to how it had been before. And there was a comfort in that, in the realization that Lucy was gone and John was off with Charlie, that I was, once again, alone. Toward nightfall I had woken, and, unable to sleep, passed an hour or two by the window, looking out at Tangier, at the city that had somehow become my home. In the quiet, I allowed myself to wonder whether I could ever love it, wondered whether I could ever really be happy if I were to remain with John. Our life was already so different from the way I had imagined it, and now that Lucy was gone, now that it was done with at last, I did not know what that would mean for John and me, whether we would be able to slip back into the normalcy that we had created together, whether that was something that either of us even wanted. I had retired to bed early then, anxious to still the swirling thoughts in my mind, if only for a moment or two longer. The knocking grew louder. I pulled my dressing gown tighter and hurried down the hallway. "Coming!" I called, my footsteps sounding against the cool tiles. I reached down and touched the brass knob, already convinced I would find John on the other side, back from gallivanting with Charlie, sulking, most likely, having misplaced his keys somewhere during his adventure, and ready for a hot bath and a cup of tea. I smiled at the familiarity, eager to dispel the image of the John from my dreams, and opened the door. It wasn't him. Instead, a man I did not recognize stood before me, a hat clutched between his hands. He was tall, his stature filling the doorway, his body, it seemed, expanding on each inhale. A scar, I noted, cut through his eyebrow, such that a patch was missing, and the smooth sheen of it, stark white against his skin, seemed to be illuminated in the darkness. I frowned, peering through the dim light into the corridor, trying to place the man in front of me.
"Pardon the early hour, Alice," he began, his accent indicating he was a fellow countryman.
I started at the sound of my name. "Yes?" I asked, regretting how small, how tentative I knew my voice sounded.
"I'm looking for your husband. He wasn't in the office yesterday, or today, in fact."
He paused, looking over my shoulder into the flat.
"As you can probably imagine, we were a bit concerned at his absence."
"Oh," I said, feeling, as I did, the relief that surged through my body at the realization it was only a concerned colleague from work that stood on my doorstep, not a policeman out of uniform, carrying with him bad news that would transform my morning nightmare into something real. "He isn't here. In Tangier, I mean. He went with his friend Charlie to Fez," I said, giving him a tentative smile. The man frowned.
"When was the last time you saw him?"
"He left yesterday afternoon, after breakfast," I said, ignoring the tiny pinpricks starting in the tips of my fingers. Can I ask what this is about?
But you saw him? He asked, ignoring my question. Yesterday, I mean, before he left.
No, I admitted, the word leaving my mouth slowly. We had a bit of a night out, and I'm afraid I slept rather late the next morning, so I didn't see him off. It seemed important, somehow, to explain how it was that I could be so unsure of my husband's movements to this stranger who stood before me, assessing. The man looked behind me again.
But he was here with you afterward?
I frowned. I was asleep when he arrived home.
Then how do you know he did? Arrive home, I mean.
I heard him, I said, defensive. But I wondered then what it was that I had in fact heard. Whether it had been John after all making breakfast the previous morning. I felt my stomach contract and worried for a moment that I might be ill. It was him. The man smiled, but there was something about the expression that made my insides clench farther still, made me shrink backward into the apartment. I thought about all of John's allusions to his cloak and dagger work. I had often scoffed at his stories, believing them to be exaggerations built on insecurity and pride, the result of having nothing but his name to cling to. But now I was seized with the thought that there might be some form of truth in them, and I wondered what that might mean about the man in front of me.
And did anything out of the ordinary happen?
He asked, not responding to my admission.
That night, I mean.
No, of course not, I said, taken aback by his question. Nothing at all. Then I thought of Lucy, our argument, and my breath caught in my throat. I was certain he had noticed it by the way his eyes narrowed. Still, after a few moments of silence, when I said nothing further, he nodded, thanked me for my time, and turned, as if intending to leave. I began to close the door, anxious now for the man to be gone. But then he paused, his face pinched in concentration.
Forgive me, he said. But what time did you say he left?
I crossed my arms tightly across my chest. Sometime in the afternoon. I'm not sure exactly. Perhaps late morning, I said, unsure just how long I had actually stayed in bed the day before. It had felt like ages and only seconds all at once. I shook my head, looking up at the man now staring intently into my face. I don't know, I'm afraid. He frowned, as if my uncertainty displeased him.
I see, he said. Well, if you hear from him...
He withdrew a card from within his suit pocket.
Please be in touch.
I took the proffered card and frowned, thinking again of that morning's dream. Is he... has something happened? He fixed me with an odd expression.
Do you think something has happened?
What? I felt my face flush. No, I only thought... I mean, I thought you were implying... I stopped, waiting for him to speak. He didn't. Instead, he pointed to the card in my hand, and then turned to leave once more. Wait, I said, my voice trembling. Should we... I mean, shouldn't I telephone the police? His brow unfurrowed, the scarred white stretch expanded, and his mouth slipped into a wide grin that made me want to do nothing so much as shut the door between myself and him, firmly, not waiting for his response.
I don't think there is any reason to do that,
he said, his voice low, placating.
After all, we wouldn't want to involve the locals in our business, would we?
I heard the force, the threat implicit in his words, despite the odd smile that clung to his lips. He turned, and at the sound of his retreating footsteps, at last I closed the door. John wasn't in Fez then, wasn't with his friend Charlie. Surely the man... I was unsure whether he had given me his name, and looking at his card realized it was nothing but a telephone number. Had already spoken with him. I thought about ringing Charlie just to make sure, before realizing I didn't actually know how to get in touch with him. I had met Charlie only a handful of times, at one party or another, and in those moments I had been convinced that he did not have a sense of who I was. Not really. He knew that John had married, knew that he was bringing his wife with him to Tangier. But my name, my face, both of these were a mystery to him, and ones I suspected he was not intent on solving. I moved to the living room, to the desk that John rarely used, the drawers transformed into a receptacle for papers and pens. Surely John had written down Charlie's contact information somewhere. I sorted through each, flinging paper to the ground around me, not caring about the mess that I was making, frantic to find something, anything at all, so long as it would help dispel the image of John's lifeless body from my mind, as long as it would stop it from becoming a reality.
What are you looking for?
I jumped at the sound of her voice, slipping in the process, my already bruised knees connecting with the hardwood floor. Lucy stood above me, her hair hanging loose around her shoulders, the long strands trailing down her soft white blouse which seemed to glow in the morning light. She gave a small laugh.
You're too easily startled, Alice.
I blinked. It wasn't a trick of the light, a trick of my mind. She was there, still. I shook my head. It wasn't possible. I had asked her, no, told her, to leave, just the other night. I remembered standing there, staring in at her, asleep in the bed, knowing that I could no longer allow my fear to persuade me to remain silent. And so I had spoken the words, had finally released them at last. It had happened.
Lucy, I sputtered, what are you doing here?
They were similar to the words that I had spoken to her the first day she had arrived in Tangier. My head felt fuzzy, weighted down, my mind filled with nothing but the certainty of her presence and the terrible implication of what that might mean. I placed my hands on the floorboards beneath me, used the force of my arms to push myself upward, grit pressing into my skin.
I told you to leave.
Lucy gave a quick, short laugh.
Don't be silly, Alice. We were tired. We had a bit too much to drink.
She gave a slight shake of her head.
You don't have to worry. I'm not going anywhere.
I could feel it, that all too familiar sensation of fear in the very center, in my very core, pushing and pulling. My limbs trembled, and I was convinced that just one more moment in her presence would undo me completely. I pushed past her, walking, practically running, back to my bedroom, back to safety. I bolted the door, my fingers fumbling over the lock. I sat in the corner of the bedroom, waiting. Earlier I had heard her footsteps as she had approached the door, heard the slight creak of the wood as she had leaned on it, presumably listening for me, just as I listened for her now. The symmetry of it made me shiver. My eyes roamed the space of the room, searching, though for what I could not explain. A way out? A trap door? Something that would let me escape from what was happening around me, a nightmare I could not wake from. My eyes fell on the telephone next to John's side of the bed. It had been an extravagance, something we had not needed. Two telephones in one small household, it was absurd, I had told him. But John had insisted, telling me he wouldn't be dragging himself out of bed and down the hall each and every time my aunt decided to check in on us. An excuse, I soon realized. What he really meant was that he wanted to be able to conduct meetings while still in bed, so that I would have to turn away, a pillow pressed against my ears in an effort to block out the sound. As I crawled toward it now, pausing every so often as a board shifted under the weight of my frame, listening, waiting, frightened at what might happen if she were to realize what I was about to do, as if Lucy could already sense my plan, as if my thoughts were able to slip from my mind, porous and unreliable as it was, I silently thanked him for the decision. Once next to the bed, I clasped the cold Bakelite between my hands, the one and only number that I had ever managed to commit to memory, ready on my lips. At the sound of her voice, I grasped the telephone tightly between my fingers.
"Alice?" Aunt Maud asked,
sounding for one moment as if she were there in the room with me and not thousands of miles away.
"Alice, what is it? What's happened?"
I wondered briefly how she had known. That it was me, that something was wrong. If she could somehow feel it, despite the distance between us. But then I remembered the operator, and I shook my head, embarrassed. "It's John," I began, realizing that she was waiting for me to speak. "He's..." I hesitated.
"He's what?"
she demanded, her voice so typically calm and measured, now sharp with panic. I thought I could feel it, vibrating through the phone.
"He's missing,"
I finally managed, the words coming out cracked, broken. "Someone from his work showed up at the flat this morning, looking for him. I told them he was supposed to be in Fez with his friend Charlie, but now I don't know if that's true." I took a deep breath. "They told me not to go to the police, but I think something has happened. And I think I know who might have been involved." There was no response.
"Auntie?"
I whispered, worried that I might have only imagined her voice a few moments before.
"Yes, Alice, I'm here."
There was another pause.
"I want you to listen carefully to me now. I am going to have my secretary book a flight to Spain, and I'll board a ferry from there. I'm not sure how long it will take to organize, but I'm going to do my best to be there by the end of the week. Do you understand?"
"Thank you," I breathed. "Thank you so much, Auntie."
I thought, then, of Aunt Maud, sturdy and solid, of her uncanny ability to take a complicated mess and sort it into something orderly and structured. I felt relief wrap itself around me, tight and comforting in its insistence.
"Alice," she said, her voice cutting into my thoughts, "I want you to promise me something."
I nodded.
"Yes, of course."
"I want you to promise me that you won't speak to the police. You said they don't know about John's disappearance yet, and I want you to promise me that you won't go and tell them."
I nodded again, though she could not see me.
"Of course," I promised.
I knew that it would not be hard to keep, for the thought of going into the station on my own, against the advice of that man with the scar from earlier, of reporting John's disappearance and trying to explain everything that had happened, caused me to pale.
"I promise, Auntie."
"Good," she said. "And if they come to question you, I want you to tell them that you won't speak without your guardian."
Again, I nodded. I still had several months left of my guardianship, and though I had felt the chains of it rankle at times, eager to be in charge of my own finances, my own life, to feel as though I were no longer a child, now I was grateful to still be tied to Maud in a way that was legal and binding. For while I knew that she was my aunt, that she was my family, I had always sensed a distance between us, a confusion on Maud's part toward the girl she had been forced to raise upon her brother's death. She had never wanted children, and though she had never complained about her duties as my guardian, a part of me often wondered whether she had resented having to take me in. I brushed aside my concerns. We made a plan to speak soon, and I was just about to place the telephone onto the receiver when I heard her voice again.
"I said, did your friend ever get in touch with you?"
I frowned.
"My friend?"
"Yes, what was her name? I noted it here somewhere."
Aunt Maud paused, and I thought I heard the rustling of papers.
"There, Sophie Turner. I ran into her on the streets of New York. Oh, it's been months now, but she said she was trying to get a hold of you. Did she ever manage?"
My fingers grasped the telephone. I had never spoken a word to Sophie Turner during my years at Bennington, and there was only one person who would have recognized Aunt Maud. Lucy. She had admitted just the other night that she had worked at a publishing company in the city. It had to have been her. I had wondered how she had found me. But then, Lucy had always managed things that others couldn't.
"Alice?"
"Yes, she did," I replied.
My voice dropped to a whisper as I looked around the room, convinced that she was listening. It was as if I could feel her presence, breathing, just there on the other side of the door, so that I shot a quick, hurried glance over my shoulder. I turned back to the telephone, still clasped between my fingers. At first I had thought to warn Aunt Maud about Lucy, to tell her that she was in Tangier and that it was happening all over again, that the fog had lifted and I had remembered everything I had wanted to forget. But the words felt too dangerous to speak aloud, the walls too thin, too tenuous. I worried that even the telephone connection might not be safe, that it too held the possibility of being altered and changed. After all, there were telephone operators stationed in Tangier. Perhaps Lucy had befriended one and convinced them to keep her apprised of any conversations that might pass between myself and others. I shook my head. It was mad. And yet, I paused, an idea growing. Perhaps if I told Aunt Maud about Sophie Turner, a sort of code for the real Lucy, the explanation would come easier once she was in Tangier. She would be able to see, then, just how devious, how manipulative Lucy Mason really was, for there would be nowhere to hide. I took a deep breath and said, "In fact, she's here now." "What, in Tangier?" my aunt questioned. I could hear the surprise, the confusion evident in her voice. "I hadn't known she was planning a visit. She didn't mention anything of the sort." "Yes," I replied. "It was all very sudden. I was quite surprised as well." There was a pause. "Well, I suppose at least that means you're not entirely alone there. Sophie must be a great source of comfort to you at the moment." I squeezed my eyes together. "Yes, Auntie, of course." I hated to lie, to make her believe something that wasn't true. But it was necessary, I told myself. "Don't worry, Alice," my aunt said, her voice once more slow and measured. "I'll be there soon enough, and I'll take care of everything, I promise." I thought of the words she had once spoken to me at Bennington, how eerily similar they were to the ones she had said just now. When I placed the telephone back onto the receiver, my hand hovered for a few moments in the empty space above, shaking.
Chapter 12. Lucy. She was an imposter. The thought came as I lay on the bed, a cigarette held between my fingers, the hot ash threatening to spill onto the sheet below me. It was a strange idea, a ridiculous one, I knew, and yet my mind lingered over the possibility, thinking once more of the look she had given me only moments before, as if I were a stranger, someone she didn't know, someone she was frightened of. Before, I had attributed her words, her behavior to John's presence, to his influence, but now that he was gone, there were no more excuses. I sat up, ash scattering onto my blouse. I brushed it away, impatient. Perhaps that was it, the reason for her curious behavior. She did not yet know that he was gone, not for sure. Perhaps I had only to tell her what I had done for her, and everything would go back to how it had been before. But then something pulled, something tugged, and I wondered what that word "before" actually meant, and just how far back we would have to go. Before John, before Tom, before all of the madness that had encircled us. The sound of voices interrupted my thoughts. Creeping to the door, I placed my ear against the wooden frame, curious. It was Alice, her voice unmistakable, but she was not singing like she had that first night, was not simply muttering aloud to herself in the empty space of her room. No, it sounded as though her words, a steady stream of them, were directed towards someone else, as if there were another person in the apartment with us. "The telephone," I realized. Opening the door, hesitantly at first so that the turn of the brass knob was all that I could hear, my ears ringing with the violence of it, I made my way carefully out into the hallway. My feet bare, I stepped over the damaged floorboard just outside my bedroom door, its texture stained and weathered. Her voice was clearer now, though still muffled. I frowned and moved toward her bedroom door. She was quiet again, and I waited, my breath held before... Yes, I could hear her, though the shape of her words were still hidden. A second passed, and then another, my frustration mounting before I remembered the telephone that I had seen in the sitting room, tucked away just behind the sofa. I did not hesitate, fearful that even a fraction of a second lost would be enough to lose the conversation. Lifting the telephone from the receiver, I placed one hand firmly across my mouth, determined they would not hear my intrusion. There was a pause, and for a second I worried that I had been caught. But no, there was Maud, I realized, speaking to her niece in a plaintive tone, demanding to know what was wrong, what had happened. I listened, eager to hear how Alice would respond. John was missing. Those were the words she spoke next, so that I was lost, momentarily unable to follow their narrative thread, puzzling over the fact that Alice knew, that somehow already she had known. She mentioned then a man at the door, someone looking for John. I cast a quick, hurried glance toward the hallway as if he might still be there. What man? I wondered silently. For while it was true I had spent most of the morning in bed, I had always slept lightly, had always woken at the slightest of sounds, and there had been nothing, nothing at all that had alerted me, that had warned me of another's presence in the flat. I thought of Alice when I had found her earlier that morning, eyes wide, hair matted and tangled, digging through John's desk drawers, obviously looking for something, though I hadn't dared ask what. And then I heard her whisper the words, "I know who did it." I heard her mention Sophie Turner, and I knew all at once what it was that she had realized, knew what it was that she was intending to do, for I knew her, Alice, better than she knew herself, could anticipate every action and reaction before they had ever occurred to her. I sunk to the floor, my fingers grasping the Berber carpet beneath me, my nails turning white against the pressure as I clutched at its frayed edges. I remained there, unable to move, though I became aware at some point of the closing of the front door, of Alice's absence from the flat, of the telephone operator still in my ear.
"Miss? Are you still there on the line, miss?"
I remained kneeling, feeling, savoring the burn of the carpet against my knees. "Yes, yes, I'm still here," I replied, my mouth dry.
"This is information again. Is there anything else I can help you with?"
I hesitated, but only for a fraction of a second.
"Yes, can you please reconnect me with the last number requested?"
"The same number, miss?"
"Yes, please."
I waited, listening to the clicks, imagining the wires being plugged and unplugged as the operator worked to connect the telephone in Alice's sitting room to one miles and miles away. I focused on this image, working hard to keep it in my mind, to not think of anything else, if only for one moment longer. It rang once, twice, and then, "Alice?" I knew already that it would be Maud who answered, had heard her voice only seconds before, and yet there was something different, a finality in the act that made me shiver, my body chilled despite the blazing heat of the afternoon. I moved to replace the telephone onto the receiver, but stopped, and bringing it back to my ear began tentatively.
"Miss Shipley?"
There was a pause.
"Yes.
It's Sophie Turner here."
"Sophie?"
I could hear the surprise register in her voice.
"Yes, I'm awfully sorry about reaching you this way, but I needed to speak with you urgently."
I stopped, held my breath, counted in my head.
"It's about Alice."
She did not hesitate to respond this time.
"Is everything all right, Sophie?"
I willed my voice to shake, to sound unsteady as I whispered into the telephone.
"No. No, I'm afraid. afraid it isn't.
I had to be quick. There was still one more thing to be done, one more telephone call to be completed before Alice returned, and one that couldn't be made from inside the flat, just in case they ever tried to